Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet and Scott Christensen of the Anchorage Press. First adrift, then aground, but always mired in controversy. That's the story of the Shell oil rig Kulik. Tell us more, Paul. Give us, first of all, the overview.
The Kulik is a 266-foot-long drilling vessel with a conical funnel-shaped hull and 160-foot derrick aboard. And more worrisome, it's got 140,000 gallons of diesel aboard and 12,000 gallons of heavier oil and hydraulic oil. The vessel had finished up shallow drilling in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas and had been taken to Dutch Harbor. And from Dutch Harbor, it was going to be taken to Seattle for refurbishment, upgrades, and maintenance. On that trip, it was being towed by the Eivik. It's a 266-foot vessel, and it's a 360-foot vessel.
That's more than a football field.
Towing it last week, tow line snapped south of Kodiak. They reattached the tow line four times. At the end of the day, the storms had managed to really batter the rig and all the tow vessels. One tug was left attached to this thing and it couldn't control it. They jockeyed it into a position and slipped the rope and let it go, hoping it would wind up on a sandy cove someplace, which it did. At that point, there were 18 people had been evacuated or were being evacuated. The vessel at this point sits in a cove off of Kodiak. I can't begin to, Sitka-Lidak Island. Sandy bottom, so if it does ground up hard, it'll be on sand and not rocks. It's there it sits at this point. The generators are destroyed aboard the vessel. Some of the hatches apparently were open, whether they were left open by crew members who left or whether they somehow came open in the storm is unknown. There's an emergency tow system in place on the deck of the vessel at this point, and I think they're doing an overall salvage review and trying to determine the condition of the vessel before they try to move it off.
And Scott, they have a unified command and they're trying to put this whole thing together in difficult circumstances, very difficult circumstances.
Yeah, it seems to me that they had some serious weather problems that limited access at first. And the unified command thing, it seems like this sort of stems from the Exxon Valdez, people who remember that spill and the coverage at the time. The number one question, which went on for days and days and days, was who's in charge? Who's in charge? Nowadays, when there's an incident, it's pretty quickly a groupthink with state and federal government, the Coast Guard, and the responsible party, in this case, Shell. One of the drawbacks has been access for journalists. We saw this down in the Gulf of Mexico when BP had their blowout, and we're seeing it here. They created a no-fly zone around this thing, and why Alaskans can't hire an Alaskan pilot to fly around Kodiak is beyond me. I don't think that there's a risk there. I think that Alaskans do a variety of flying, sometimes in crowded skies around Denali. Sometimes, if you've read about the flying around herring fisheries, where they're actually spotting fish in the water and the pilots have to avoid each other and they're flying over a crowded sea as well with people, you could see pretty easily that it wouldn't be that big a deal for someone to go there and take some pictures.
It is interesting. The weather. When you see the daily news every day, the photographs are courtesy of the United States Coast Guard, unless they're on land. I see Bob Hallen and of the staff has been down there at Old Harbor and other places.
Yeah. And it occurs to me that these no-fly zones created by the Unified Command don't serve anyone except for Shell in this case.
Well,
and
presumably, it might also serve I assume the government's making the argument that this is a safety question, that they don't.
Yes, well, we're not talking about seven helicopters chasing cop cars around Los Angeles. You know, there just aren't that many people. You can fly from the north end of Kodiak to the south end. The only other airplanes you'll see are the ones you left behind at the runway.
Okay, let's go back to Paul. Paul, this immediately becomes not just an environmental question or a social question of what it might mean to the villagers and various areas around Kodiak, becomes a political question. As people choose up sides in the blame or not blame shell game?
Well, the I think the sides were chosen long before this incident. We have people waiting for this incident or an incident like it. The usual suspect, Natural Resources Defense Council, Wilderness Society, Sierra Club immediately attacked Shell as being unprepared to not ready for the Arctic was their battle cry. They say Shell is not capable of drilling in the Arctic, and when they're up in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, they'll be far away from Coast Guard support. Shell responds, well, we've got our own fleet, $1 billion fleet up there that we can deal with this with. I think there's two things to keep in mind here. One, I think, is that the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas are nothing like the Gulf of Alaska. It's shallower. Storms up there of the magnitude you see in the Gulf of Alaska on a weekly basis are fairly rare. So we've got a shallow sea. We've got a rarity of storms like that up there. And at this particular instance, there's been no spills. There's been no spill of diesel, no spill of anything. So right so far, as we tape this, Alaska has been very lucky. And yes, there are going to be policy implications. We've got the House Sustainable Energy and Environment Coalition, 45 Democrats, demanding an investigation of Shell's preparedness to drill in the Arctic.
We should note they're in the minority.
They're very much in the minority at this point in the Republican-led House. The Obama administration, through Interior Secretary Salazar, has said, no, we're not going to turn our backs on drilling offshore in the Arctic. However, he has not yet issued the deep water permits they need for next year. And he may be
presumably at some point there'll be a very intense, about this discussion.
The pressure is going to be on between now and next summer to have those permits pulled or delayed that are already issued for the shallow. But he needs to reissue the deep water ones and the deep drilling ones. And I think the pressure is going to be pretty amazing. It's going to be a heck of a fight.
Anything you want to add here, Scott, before we move on this subject?
Oh, I just say, I thought when I first heard that this thing was stuck adrift, I thought about, my own experience. I haven't been at sea except for ferry trips to and from Kodiak. So I've never really been on the high seas for any amount of time. But I've lost a canoe. I've lost a tackle box. I've lost a bobber. I think Shell's lucky that this thing landed on an island.
Yeah. And it could have landed on a reef or other things could have happened, right?
Yeah. It could be bobbing around in the middle of Gulf of Alaska, upside down or otherwise difficult to get a hold of.
Okay. You've been looking at the APOC complaint against lobbyist Dan Coffey. What have you discovered?
Well, Alaska Public Office Commission, I was here for the story about 2 weeks in, not when it was breaking, but after Coffey filed a reply document at APOC at the commission. And he's defending himself against this complaint. Dan Coffey is a former assemblyman, and he took a contract in November of 2011 to be a lobbyist for the city on behalf of Port of Anchorage.
And he has a reputation locally in public affairs here in Anchorage as a super lobbyist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, he was a land use attorney. He still is. And one of the things he's done is advocate on behalf of businesses who need changes from the city. There's no lobbying requirements at the city level, no registration requirements for lobby. What the state requires is for lobbyists who are going to lobby to the legislature is that they register and that they not make campaign contributions.
Outside of their own district.
Outside of their own district. So he made about 28 campaign contributions in various House districts since signing that contract. Coffey's defense, he's lawyered up. He has a lawyer named Thomas Amodio, an Anchorage attorney. I don't know much about him. But they filed a reply brief and a reply document. And Coffey says he's done nothing wrong. There is a threshold of the law that says if you're lobbying more than 10 hours in a 30-day period, then you must register. There's problem for Coffey is there's another portion of the law that says once you represent yourself as a lobbyist.
Here's what I don't understand. The truth is I should call up Mr. Coffey and get his perspective, I suppose. But if he wasn't lobbying, what was he doing?
Well, no, he's actually willing, according to the letter from Amadeo, he's willing to do to show time accounting that shows he was lobbying under the 10-hour threshold.
Oh, but he was under the 10-hour threshold, okay.
Yeah. The problem is this other wrinkle in the law, which Amadeo, I believe, is going to have to attack. It says that if you declare yourself a lobbyist and put yourself out for hire, then you must register immediately. I don't know... It would appear that Coffey and his attorney have their ducks in a row as far as the arguments they're about to make. They've offered to show Coffey's time accounting for the job that he's doing for the city. They've pointed out to the commission some previous case law that they've studied. And it's a rather long reply document that basically says Coffey's done nothing wrong.
How long will it take to resolve this incident controversy?
That depends on the commission. You know, what happens is if a party isn't satisfied, they go to court. And we know from, in one of the cases that Mr. Amadeo cites is the Ben Stevens case. You end up in court and it takes longer.
And the Ben Stevens case as when he was working for Vico, is that what you're referring
to? Yeah. It had to do with Ben Stevens being a senator, not a lobbyist,
okay.
But having this contract that said he was a consultant.
Okay. That, if I might interject, that's the difference in Alaska state law. And it's really kind of a catch, and a catch 22, the consultant phrase. Are you a consultant or are you a lobbyist? And if you're a consultant, the rules are way different than if you're a lobbyist. If I was going to be something, I'd be a consultant. I wouldn't be a lobbyist. They can pretty much do what they want to do, charge what they want to charge. The lobbyists and lobbyists have to register. I don't think consultants do.
A lobbyist, by definition, somebody who talks to the executive branch or the legislative branch or administrators or something. Consultant could be talking to the head of the corporation or something.
Lobbyists are educators. They're there to educate. Lawmakers on various subjects that they're not familiar with. And don't get me wrong. Lobbyists perform a necessary and good job in our system, because without them, we would have legislator Schmo voting on growing mushrooms, and he's never seen one before. So you have guys come in and say, "This is what a mushroom looks like."
Are you saying we might elect people who don't know anything about something?
Well, absolutely.
On the other hand, about half the members of the House of Representatives who are retired U.S. House of Representatives are lobbyists.
That's because they know the system and they can educate you.
Yes, and they're well paid for it.
Yes, sir.
Paul, about two-thirds of the Republicans in the U.S. House did not join Speaker John Boehner in the bill that kept us off the fiscal cliff. They voted against the Speaker. Don Young joined the Speaker.
The ones who voted against, the people who voted against this, are very concerned about spending, and they wanted to tie spending to the taxes. And without cutting spending, they didn't want to go along with anything. So Don Young, our congressional delegation, all three of them, voted for this. But Don Young said that, there's political reality. This is the best deal you're going to get. You've got a president with all the cards. You can fight and lose today, or you can go along and get what you can and come back later. And 2 months from now, when they've managed to push back the automatic cuts for 2 months, in 2 months that fight will start anew. It'll be
the fact that the majority leader, Eric Cantor of Virginia, voted against the Speaker?
I would say
that's unusual.
And then they came back and revoted the Speaker into his position. I mean, to me, you would think if you had that kind of dissatisfaction in the ranks, your tenure would be up. Apparently not. I think they have honest, principled differences. I think they recognize that.
And one of the things that surprised me with the color of the hair I have was to learn that you do not have to be a member of the House of Representatives to get elected Speaker. That explains how yesterday or earlier this week, there were a number of votes for people who aren't members of the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
Something quite surprising.
Unbelievable.
Scott, the nose knows. This is a headline in the Anchorage Press, a story of that you worked on. Tell us, what does that mean?
Well, this is another search warrant case in a series of search warrant cases in which defense attorneys for people growing marijuana have been attacking the state troopers' search warrants. And it's not just state troopers. They have a task force in Mat-Su that includes cops from Wasilla and Palmer, and may occasionally include a DEA agent. And I have a feeling these cases are going on around the state, but this particular story was about, in preparation for the search warrant, the troopers brought some statistics to a magistrate. And the statistics showed that more than 90% of the time when you can smell the weed from the street, there's a major grow operation in the area, an illegal one. And the magistrate bought into this idea and granted the search warrant. That was attacked at the Superior Court level, and it went to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals has accepted it. They didn't say that these statistics were sort of sound science. They didn't say that the troopers, in fact, they admitted that the trooper statistics were kind of flawed in certain ways. But that would drop it down to about 80% of the time. And also, the state pointed out that the reason the troopers have this stat isn't to prove that the pot is being grown in a specific home, but to prove that it's being grown somewhere in the area. And then they use other information to track it down to a specific home.
If I might, the Supreme Court has been taking up, or is going to take up, a case involving the use of dogs, dope-smelling dogs, and the question of the limit that they can be put to. It seems to me if there's a question about how much dope-smelling dogs can smell, isn't there a question also about police officers or their allies?
Well, the dog can't explain to the magistrate how much experience he has in detecting drugs, where the trooper can. You see, that's one difference.
This is, you can't cross-examine the dog? Is that what we're talking about here?
Right, and if the magistrate is strict, before they grant the search warrant, they're going to ask this cop, how much experience do you have? How much have you really worked with marijuana? And how much do you know about these grow operations? Another interesting thing is, before you get the search warrant, before a trooper gets the search warrant, they're going to have to show other things about which home they expect the pot to be in. And in the case that was just upheld, the people who owned the house had previously been busted for growing marijuana in the same house.
And they didn't get the memo, don't do it again?
They didn't get the don't do it again memo. And furthermore, the troopers had access to their electric bills.
Yeah.
And showed the difference between the bills. That's happening in Matanuska Electric territory. What I'm really curious about is, what if this were MLP or a government-owned utility? Would that make a difference? Because the privacy clause in our state constitution seems to apply to government sharing information or government invading your privacy. It doesn't necessarily apply to the people at MEA invading your privacy.
Okay, good story, thank you very much. Paul, Senator Murkowski says it's time to rein in the super PACs, and she and Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon have formed something of a coalition. They had an op-ed piece they wrote together that said we really have to make some changes. Tell us more, Paul.
Well, she and Mr. Wyden believe that the anonymity granted under the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, which allows corporations, unions, everybody, anybody wants to set up an independent political
pack.
To not specifically say vote for or against a specific candidate, it leads to very vicious down in the dirt kind of campaigning, and it made the last campaign cycle not fun, I suppose is the best way to describe it. So she and he have they penned a piece in the Washington Post in which pretty much the upshot of it is they want to go to real-time I guess it's real-time disclosure. So if you are a billionaire and you want to throw money into one of these things and attack a candidate, we know immediately, not 3 months from now, we know immediately who you are and what you're about. It's interesting to me that Alaska's Standing Together in 2010 gathered up about $1.8 million in something like 2 or 3 months for her campaign against Joe Miller in the general election. So. I get, and that campaign was about as nasty as one can get. She may have a point.
Well, part of what they're concerned about is the kind of thing the New York Times followed and the Washington Post followed, whether it be huge contributions to some organization, Citizens for a Better America, and they tried to find out who was running it, who's in charge of it, and they trace it to a postal box in Naples, Florida, and then when they found out who owned the who rented the postal box, and they called up that person, the person hung up.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to put an end to.
They're trying to put an end to, and right away. I mean, like, immediately.
Okay, but what do you suppose the prospects are for something like this, even though it has bipartisan support?
Well, if you've got, well, I think they estimated, what, $6 billion across the country or something like that? It was a phenomenal amount of money involved in this. Yeah, it was $6 billion. I can't believe that Congress is going to say, yeah, you're right. Let's just put an end to that right now. Because, I mean, if you benefit from it, it's a wonderful thing. If you don't, it's not.
Well, the question in some measure here is whose ox is being gored.
Exactly.
Paul, the state Supreme Court rules against the reapportionment board and tells them they have an imperfect reapportionment. They're going to have to go back to work and satisfy the court.
Earlier court case, the redistricting board was ordered, if you will, to consider the redistricting by first, incorporating Alaska constitutional principles.
The Hickel ruling.
Right, the Hickel ruling. On the other hand, when that was done, then they were to worry about whether it met federal muster. We're one of the few states left in the union, I guess, that still has federal Department of Justice oversight on our elections under the
I think there's some smaller jurisdictions as well.
There are, in fact. So what has happened here is the Supreme Court said it's clear to them that that the redistricting board didn't do that, that it first considered a minority status and when it set up the districts, and then when it went to do the federal districts, instead of only changing what it had to change, it changed virtually nothing. 36 districts that had not been contested were left untouched. So they said, well, you didn't do what we told you to do, so do it again. And I think that that's where we are. The first one they came up with, of course, we used in the last election, but the 2014 elections, I think we're going to wind up with a new redistricting system that these guys can
And
get
it's
together.
Possible that they won't redistrict the whole state again.
Not again.
That it will just apply
right.
to Fairbanks and some Bush areas, as that was the center of controversy.
Exactly. And if they can do that and still manage to mollify the federal government, I guess we're in good shape.
Scott, setting off fireworks in Anchorage is illegal. But if you were awake on New Year's Eve at midnight, you may have noticed, not you, I'm speaking to the general public, I know you were awake, that there were some fireworks. The public seems to take the view of what? No harm, no foul? I just want to have fun? What?
Yeah, I think so. And I hadn't been covering the politics or legal stuff behind this, but about 3 years ago, Assemblyman Dick Cheney came on with what a lot of people believe is a modest proposal. There's always been people firing off fireworks on New Year's Eve. Why don't we make it legal for that one night? They hemmed and hawed. The assembly established a 3.5-hour window for New Year's Eve each year. It lasted 2 years. It had a sunset clause. Dick Cheney, I called him this week, and he described it as an experiment to see how well things went. And when he tried to reinstate it, the assembly turned him down. Mr. Cheney got a lot of calls and took quite a bit of heat for this, what seems to be a rather small issue. And he tells me that this year he got maybe two or three complaints about fireworks.
This is before or after, or both?
This is after, actually. This year it was illegal, and yet his phone still continued to ring with people who wanted to blame him. However, 2 years ago, you know, the complaints, there was like a dozen. You know, the trainees keep a listed phone number there in the book. Anyone can call them. So he took a little bit of heat. And he told me that 2 years ago, a man called claiming that they had moved a pony indoors because he didn't want the pony spooked by the fireworks. He needed to call Assemblyman Cheney afterwards and tell him that the pony had relieved itself in the living room.
And so,
sometimes being a local elected official is a thankless job, and sometimes you might get blamed for someone else's soiled carpet.
And where do the good citizens of Anchorage who want fireworks, and by the way, the residue was all over my neighborhood, so I got a chance to look myself, where do they get their fireworks?
Well, I think the Anchorage market goes to Houston, which is one of a few places you can sell fireworks legally.
And you can see the guy in the gorilla suit.
Yeah, yeah, and that is within Houston city limits, which is a pretty large area along the Parks Highway, you may notice. There was some things, Houston incorporated in, I believe, the early 70s.
Here's something that surprised me. I just tried it on you. I was in one of the big box stores in Fairbanks last weekend when I was in Fairbanks, and there was a box of firecrackers. They were selling for $100 a container. They weren't cherry bombs, but mostly they were kind of sparkler type things or small, explosive, colorful batters.
There seems to be a class of
fire. Does this go on all over the United States, or is this just Fairbanks once again?
No, I've seen them in Wasilla and in Anchorage at rather large grocers. I believe that's a Class D firework. I'm not sure about the different classifications, but like black cats are Class C fireworks.
Oh, and aren't there some you can throw on the floor and they'll make a little noise, and if they can be used indoors safely?
I'm not sure about indoor use. I imagine the labels tell you not to do that. But if you have to drive to Houston, you're dealing with Class C fireworks.
And if you're going to drive to Houston, you want to get your money's worth, right?
Yeah, people have been known to drop $100 bills there.
Okay. Well, we've gotten our money's worth, and we're out of time. Thank you so much for Alaska Edition, and we'll see you here next week at the same time.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.